Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Suzanne Martinez, she's an attorney and vice president for public policy of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Ms. Martinez has also served as the policy director of the Children's Defense Fund and as a congressional staffer. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Now, the Planned Parenthood Federation is much vilified by the Christian right because some of its clinics have provided abortion services, but it's much broader than that. So let's first get into the notion of what is the concept of family planning, Planned Parenthood, according to the Planned Parenthood Federation, and the kind of reproductive health services that it is providing?
Uh-huh. Sure. Well, first of all, I think it's important to know that Planned Parenthood has existed for nearly 90 years. It was founded by Margaret Sanger 9 decades ago in order to make sure that all people have the information and means to decide basically freely and responsibly about whether and when to have children. When she first did her work in New York in a very impoverished communities, women had no access to birth control. It was illegal in the United States to do anything to prevent a pregnancy. And she, along with other public health people across the nation and around the world, really began what is today the modern family planning program, which is to make the means and the information available to women. We today in the United States, Planned Parenthood has close to 900 health clinics around the country with 122 affiliates working in every state, trying to help people make responsible choices based on accurate information. And that's truly the overriding mission of Planned Parenthood. We provide information, contraception, and counseling on the full range of options that people have to control whether they have children. We include screening for cancer and sexual transmitted diseases when we see patients, and we encourage communication about issues relating to sex education and family planning generally.
Now, the Bush administration says that freedom is on the march around the world, and when the Planned Parenthood Federation, which is also an international, there's the International Federation that you're part of,
right,
when you look across the globe, is reproductive health access increasing, or is it under challenge?
Well, it's very interesting. We made a lot of progress in the past decade that is actually being tremendously threatened right now by the Bush administration. In 1994, the nations of the world came together and forged what's called the Cairo Consensus, which was a global agreement about making sure that all couples, all women around the world do have access to family planning services. And that was based upon a sense that it was important for them, not only for their countries in terms of economic development, to be able to control population growth, but that freedom was tied to the ability to control your reproduction and that it was essential. Now, in the decade that passed since that historic meeting of nations around the world, the other countries have stepped forward. They have moved ahead to try to provide assistance to developing countries to enable them to make family planning services available, but the United States has done everything it could in an official capacity to undermine that progress. There are conferences that have been held in international forum where the U.S. representatives have come in and tried to undermine the consensus, tried to promote their abstinence-only agenda in place of access to family planning services. So, fortunately, the other nations have rejected this sort of backward approach that our country has been promoting overseas. And for many of us, for the last, under the first 4 years of the Bush administration, we have worried a great deal that what they have tried to do overseas is going to be brought back to this country as the second term begins, that the thing where they have attacked, for example, the condom use in Africa, and a variety of sort of backward steps that will escalate in this country now that they have begun to consolidate their power and their agenda becomes more and more apparent.
Well, let's start with, before we get back to the domestic scene, I just want to ask, some people charge, or some people would respond, that as the Bush administration has determined that we have certain priorities for not funding abortion-related services and funding certain other kinds of services, that the Europeans have picked up that slack. Do you think that that's generally true, or is there actually a shortfall in the provision of certain kinds of reproductive health services because we refuse to fund them?
Well, what's interesting is this has never been an issue about whether the U.S. government will pay for abortions. That's been outlawed in U.S. policy for decades and decades. What the issue has really been about is whether programs, which the global gag rule, you may have heard reference to in some of the background materials that have circulated, is a rule that says that you cannot receive family planning money if you refer any of your patients for abortion services or if you advocate in your own country for legalization of abortion. You cannot get any contraceptives to hand out. Now, that is so incredibly foolish. In other words, the best way to reduce the number of abortions around the world is to make family planning services readily available because it's really the unintended pregnancies that lead to abortion, and to prevent that is the most effective way to reduce the number of abortions. And what the administration has done is cut off any family planning provider who refused to comply with their censorship. In other words, if a patient comes in and says, tell me where I can go to get an abortion, if they respond, they will lose their funds. And if they advocate, if they petition for any kind of legalization in their country, they would be barred from family planning funds. So while other countries have stepped forward in providing more funds for family planning services to try to help fill the void that we have created, there's no way that the Western nations can make up for the U.S.'s abandoning this field. When they withdrew money from China, allegedly because of coerced abortion, even though a team of experts who were handpicked by the Bush administration sent there and said no U.S. funds are used for any coercive abortion services. The money was taken away from the U.N. for its family planning programs. And that's the sort of the net result of these policies.
Okay, so the Christian right in the States, this was a sop that the Bush administration and previous Republican administrations had thrown to the Christian right, that will restrict these global services according to a Christian agenda, and there's no one who really cares about developing world women in the States, so what do we lose? But now you're saying that they're going to bring it back here, and I understand there's already been huge fights in Washington over the science around abstinence education, whether the different policy agencies of the U.S. will recognize that abstinence doesn't work.
Yeah, and I think I have to say that it's really important when we talk about abstinence to understand that the position of responsible sex education programs is not that abstinence is something that should be encouraged, particularly for younger teens. Our problem is the abstinence only part of it, and it's the only words. That when you withhold information from young people about what to do if they do become sexually active, you put them at risk. And that ultimately is our greatest concern, is that you expose these young people to the risk of unintended pregnancy, to the risk of sexually transmitted diseases if they do become sexually active. And we know that the vast majority of young people do at some point before marriage become sexually active, and they need to know the facts about how you do become pregnant, how you do need to take steps to avoid sexually transmitted diseases. And what the Congressman Waxman recently released a study of the abstinence-only curriculum that has been promoted by the sort of the right groups. And it's just full of false statements, misinformation. And again, this is not what our young people need. They need accurate, age-appropriate information to help them make their way to adulthood in a responsible way.
I'm speaking with Suzanne Martinez. She's the Vice President for Public Policy of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. She also served as the Policy Director of the Children's Defense Fund, and she's an attorney. This is Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. One of the things that we see coming up on the radar now, Planned Parenthood's a 501c3, so... Okay, so I'm not asking you for any particular vote 'em up, vote 'em down kind of advice, but maybe you could reflect a little bit on how the upcoming appointments that the Bush administration may have the chance to make to the Supreme Court may affect women's access to, for instance, abortion.
Well, it's very much something that's on all of our minds in terms of people who are concerned about Roe v. Wade remaining the law of the land and that... access to safe, legal abortion continue. Bush has made it clear that he would like to see the decision overturned, and the fact that the balance on the court right now is very, very close, and the appointment of one or two new members could result in that landmark safety net, which women have enjoyed the protection of for the last 33 years, could be eroded if appointments are made of people who have an ideological agenda, which is to overturn Roe. And the president has said he would like to appoint justices in the model of Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia, who have consistently argued that the case should be overturned.
Well, so what are we going to do about it?
Well, I think the most important thing is for people to understand what is at stake. If you wanted to identify the greatest risk to American women today in terms of reproductive freedom, it is complacency. Most people don't believe that Roe could be overturned. There has actually been a calculated dissemination of information suggesting, oh, that couldn't happen. Just lull the public into believing that rights that are established could not be overturned. And I think that that sort of belief lays the groundwork for the other side to quietly, stealthily move forward their agenda, which is to make abortion illegal in this country. I think the second thing is people are totally unaware of the attack upon birth control itself. I think it is often characterize that this is a struggle about abortion only. And when you look at the record and listen to what the opponents of abortion say and look at the voting records of those in Congress who continually announce they oppose abortion, want to have it made illegal, they also vote against family planning programs. The fact that the Bush administration recently forced the FDA into refusing to comply with the recommendations of the scientific committees that were convened to look at whether emergency contraception should be made available over the counter. And the fact that they rejected the scientific recommendations, I think, is again an example of the fact that it is not just abortion. It is birth control itself, which is under assault.
So we're talking about the morning after pill?
Yes, the morning after pill.
Okay, and there is a growing Christian backlash against the morning after pill because some Christian theologians and pharmacists apparently believe that this is an abortifacient drug. So can you explain that controversy to us?
Well, I mean, they make the argument that depending on what point in a woman's cycle she takes the pill, and this goes to the pill, not just to emergency contraception. There, some of the pharmacists around the country who were refusing to fill birth control prescriptions are arguing that it can have the effect of being an abortifacient if it inhibits a fertilized egg from implanting in the woman's uterus, is the simplest way to say that. And I think that it's very important for people to understand that the opposition to emergency contraception, there's no sort of physiological reason that it would not extend to the what we call the regular birth control. It's the same theory that would apply to the birth control pill, and many of them are very clear about that, that they believe that birth control pills are abortifacients just as emergency contraception is. Emergency contraception is just, I mean, an increased dose of the hormone which is in the birth control pill. It's, again, a simplification, but women have been using it for, you know, as long as the pill has been out. Women's magazines years ago had this sort of the recipe, how many pills you needed to put together to create emergency contraception. And what we have now is, you know, is obviously a medication that is that builds on that to have and be able to call it an emergency contraception.
Within the Catholic moral teachings on this stuff, they're opposed to birth control altogether, whether it's whether it interferes with the implantation of a fertilized egg or not, because they believe that every sex act should have the option of being a reproductive act.
That's right. That's right. That's why they oppose condoms, which are obviously barrier and have no, you know, no possible abortifacient effect. So yes, you're correct.
And the Catholic Church has recently gotten into a lot of trouble in the, for instance, in Africa, because they've been telling people that it's not a good barrier method for the prevention of HIV.
I know. And that's actually, I mean, that's it's so so deadly to be doing that when we know that the use of condoms is one of the only effective way to reduce transmission among people who are sexually active. And so in the United States, at least there's enough information out that people can have access to the information they need to protect themselves. But in developing countries like Africa, when that kind of barrier is placed in the way of people getting both the information and access to condoms, it's you know, very deadly.
What's the current access to RU486 in the United States? This is a drug that you can take up through, what, the 10th week or the 12th week of after conception?
Yeah, it's about 63 days is the time period in which it works. RU486, which is called mifepristone in the United States, is available. It provides a medical abortion within the, that early period of a pregnancy. And it was made available to women in the United States a few years ago. It's been available in Europe for over a decade. Around the world, there's probably been about a million women who have used it. In the United States, it's about 200,000 by the most recent figures that I've seen. So it's you know, since it was made available, it's grown in its usage for a variety of reasons, and it's effective for early pregnancy.
When we were fighting over getting it into the United States, there was an argument that this would remove the debate about abortion altogether, because women would be able to take this at home and would never have to go to a clinic and never have to brave the gauntlet of the anti-choice protesters and whatnot. Hasn't seemed to change things that much.
No, I guess it really hasn't. I think it's made it an easier procedure for some women who, for whom a surgical procedure might be not something they wanted to do. But the fact that it absolutely has to be prescribed in a medical office, it doesn't have to be in a setting that maybe is clinical as you would for a surgical procedure, but it still has a lot of safeguards around it so that it's not certainly not readily accessible.
You could have bleeding as a side effect.
Yes, and I think that it's a situation where you have to be careful at what stage of gestation is taken so that it will be effective, and do you need medical supervision as you're using it.
Now, there's been some argument recently, I'm sure you saw the article in Slate about 6 months ago, that contrasted the pro-choice movement with the movement around infertility treatment choice. There's a national organization of parents who have used infertility treatment. And it's interesting in that context to think, what would a movement that tried to expand reproductive options on that end, as well as the family planning end, what would that movement look like? I mean, have you or have people in the women's movement that you know of begun to think about the role of reproductive technology, infertility treatment, and so on, as an empowerment of women in particular and families in general?
Well, I think generally, yes, we do. I mean, we're very supportive of the ability of families to plan not only to prevent a pregnancy, but also to have a pregnancy. And so the reproductive technology that's being developed and has been developed since, you know, for the past decade or so with the in vitro fertilization is something that we've been very supportive of. In fact, we have been fearful that those who oppose abortion because of their concerns about the fertilized egg having a status of a person have also tried to inhibit research into reproductive technologies that would help families have children. And I think that that sort of opposition to interference with what they describe as nature runs the gamut of reproductive choices. So in vitro fertilization has been opposed by some of the hardline right groups as vehemently as they do other, you know, things in the reproductive rights area, partly because the unused fertilized eggs may be destroyed, partly because they don't believe there should be any interference with what they call natural processes. But we as a movement feel very, very supportive of the right of women to have children when they want to have them and through the mechanisms that may support that.
I'm sure that you saw recently that the UN agency that's considering an international human rights convention on the rights of the disabled considered the notion of recommending an international ban on women being able to make choices about aborting congenitally deformed fetuses. Mm-hmm. And you may not be aware that the Indian Medical Association recently recommended that all Indian women should be forbidden to have ultrasounds and abortions on the grounds that it was impossible to control sex selection as long as those were available for any reason. And so those two things put together, my question is, has the international family planning movement given, I'm sure you have, what kinds of thought are they giving to this challenge that many people think that women can have abortions for the wrong reasons and for the right reasons, and that the logic of saying you can't have them for the wrong reasons eventually ends up, as these two bans suggest, in restricting women's reproductive choices altogether?
Well, I think to begin with, I mean, there's a slippery slope here that, and you, I think, hit it on the nail, that when, you know, when governments start deciding what's a good reason to have an abortion and what's a bad reason, you end up with all kinds of judgments of particular people in power at different times. And, you know, reasons that people feel are legitimate for themselves, their situation, their capacity to bear burdens. Our belief is that women are capable of making those decisions free of government interference, that the people who can best make the decision and best raise a child are those who are involved directly, that women do care about these decisions and they are guided by their own moral, religious beliefs and their and those things. Now, there's a difference between approving as a social matter, reasons, you know, sex selection, disability, and making it illegal. Because one of the things that happens if you pass laws and say it's illegal to do it for this reason and it's okay to do it for that reason, you have to enforce those laws. And that means you have to bring women before, you know, this is, you know, looking ahead, tribunals or something like that to prove, oh, you know, your choice is one of the ones we approve and yours is, you know, you have to prove that you're doing it for the right reasons. And I think most Americans would be horrified at the notion that we would have to try each woman in terms of her justifying that her reasons were legitimate in terms of some standard that someone else would establish. The way to deal with things like propensity to sex selection is to change the value, for example, of women in these societies. I mean, where most of the cases where sex selection has become an issue, it's because women are not valued and men are valued. And so the desire to have a male child is what drives this activity. And once you begin to understand that women have value and that daughters have value and make sure that the society supports them, those kinds of sex selection issues can go away. The same thing with disability issues. I mean, the important thing there is that parents, prospective parents, understand what, you know, what supports are available, what the real extent of disabilities are, and give them the information upon which to make their decision. Don't pass laws making criminals out of people who are facing difficult choices in their lives.
Suzanne, I really want to thank you for joining us today. I've been speaking with Suzanne Martinez. She's the Vice President for Public Policy of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Suzanne, can you tell us, as one final question, how can people get involved in support for women's reproductive health services? How can they join the work of Planned Parenthood?
Well, we have a network, and we have email listservs to keep you advised as to what is going on. You can access our website at PlannedParenthood.org. That's one word, PlannedParenthood.org. And there's a wealth of information there. And in your local communities, there are Planned Parenthood, as I mentioned before, we have over 800 clinics across the country, 122 affiliates, so you can access them locally to get engaged in local issues and state issues and national issues.
This is the Free Radicals with a bit of Killer Bee Honey. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.